against Palestinian prisoners.
Meanwhile, a workshop was held in the blockaded territory on how to tackle the dangers posed by right-wing Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir on Palestinian prisoners. The workshop was organized by Hamas's Wa'id Prisoners Society and the Islamic Jihad's Mujahid al-Quds Foundation for Prisoners. Attendees discussed ways of confronting threats by the extremist Israeli minister.
It's our duty to protect and fight for Palestinian prisoners amid the ongoing attempts by Ben-Gvir and the Zionist entity to pass a law that allows the execution of Palestinian prisoners as well as the deportation of Palestinian prisoners. We are facing a big Zionist project targeting not only the prisoners but also all aspects of Palestinian existence.
For decades, the Israeli regime has violated all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention.
The issue of Palestinian prisoners is at the core of the Palestinian cause. They are held in Zionist jails because they fought for the freedom of Palestine and have kept the Palestinian cause alive. Palestinian prisoners have played a major role in fighting the Zionist project that aims to empty Palestine of its indigenous Palestinian population.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to break their silence and help Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
We will not be beaten. This is the title of a newly released documentary produced by Press TV. The documentary has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents collected and released by the U.S. media regarding domestic violence against women and the violation of women's rights in the United States. We Will Not Be Beaten tells the documented story of the high rate of domestic violence and physical abuse against women in the U.S.
This documentary, ordered by Press TV, has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents regarding violation of women's rights and violence against women, which have been collected and released by the U.S. media. Also, in order to have a better understanding of the situation in the United States, we have interviewed many people who have been living in the U.S. for 10 to 20 years.
According to official statistics, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines in the U.S. every day. Moreover, one in every three women in the U.S. experience rape and physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime.
This documentary has shown the realities regarding violation of women's rights and domestic violence against women in the United States. It shows that the only thing that the U.S. does not care about is the rights of women. One example is the U.S. proposed resolution which led to the ouster of Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. The production of such documentaries will further shed light on the double standards policies of Washington with regard to women's rights.
While Western media outlets have launched a propaganda against Iran with regard to the status of women, we have released a new documentary titled We Will Not Be Beaten to depict the true status of women in the U.S. As Press TV has been the voice of the voiceless, we have made our efforts to be the voice of the rising number of American women who are facing domestic violence and physical abuse on a daily basis.
Domestic violence against women has seen an alarming uptick in recent years in the United States, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. A report by the Council on Criminal Justice found that reports of domestic violence in the U.S. have jumped by over 8% during the pandemic lockdown.
As Press TV documentary has shown, the high rate of violence against women in the U.S. has been recognized as a public health concern, with media in the U.S. contributing to making domestic violence appear unimportant to the public. Experts say given such realities on the ground, the U.S. cannot serve as a role model for women's rights in the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
United States President Joe Biden has visited the Mexican border for just the first time in his presidency. An estimated 8,000 asylum seekers cross the Texas border every day, with last year breaking records.
Official data showed that the number of undocumented immigrant crossings at the southwest border reached 2.8 million people, breaking the annual record by more than 1 million.
In yet another major expansion of a policy of Donald Trump, which the Democratic Party criticized for years, Biden announced the U.S. will immediately deport even more new arrivals. Biden has also drastically increased the number of deportations from the Trump era. The United States accepts fewer refugees per capita than almost any other Western nation, and the world's wealthiest country refuses to provide adequate resettlement and border services.
Let's not forget that the Biden administration still is running the very same for-profit internment camps on the southern border that are full of immigrants. When Trump was president, there was rightfully a lot of criticism of these policies. These are not just holding cells or whatever. These are basically internment camps where large numbers of immigrants, including families and children, are held.
Rarely discussed in the mainstream media is that U.S. foreign policy has played a major role in the Western Hemisphere's long-running refugee crisis. Instead, both the media and Biden's immigration policy give special priority to asylum seekers leaving socialist-inspired nations, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
Encouraging them to leave these countries that have socialist governments. And then, of course, the U.S. government says, look at these people fleeing so-called communism. It's exactly what the Biden administration's spokespeople have been saying. It's basically, you know, right-wing Cold War-style propaganda. And the reality is that these people are not fleeing. These people are going to the United States because the U.S. is telling them, we're going to give you visas.
2022 saw seemingly the entire West accused of racism due to their privileging of refugees from Ukraine over non-white asylum seekers. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Braving the bone-chilling weather, mourners are remembering those who gave their lives for the future of this region and beyond.
These people gathered here to pay tribute to martyrs to the war against the key terrorist groups in the region who were backed by the U.S.
General Qasem Soleimani was remembered as a hero for humanity who transcended geographical and ethnic boundaries and whose campaign against the Daesh terrorist groups saved every Muslim and non-Muslim country, including Pakistan.
Shahid Qasem Soleimani.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani is a way of life and a school of thought to fight the enemies of the Muslim world and the East. If the world of Islam and countries in the East want to save themselves from the malicious designs of the West aimed at breaking this region into pieces to create its new world order, then they have to follow Qasem Soleimani and the strategies he used to save the West Asia region from the collapse.
Speakers at the gathering shed light on different dimensions of martyr Soleimani's life and his legacy, as well as how it impacted the region.
The U.S. and its Western allies had remained helpless and in despair in the face of global terrorism. Martyr Qasem Soleimani put an end to the darkness of this hopelessness vis-a-vis U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorism.
Some 70,000 Pakistani citizens have been killed at the hands of U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorists, including in attacks on schools and children. These were the same terrorists that General Soleimani took out in an anti-terror campaign for which he will always be remembered. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
The two-year anniversary of the election integrity protest, which burst into Congress on January 6, 2020, has been overshadowed by Congress's historic failure to select the third most important post in the country, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. After more than a dozen votes, mainstream Republican Kevin McCarthy finally won a majority, ending the total paralysis of the new Congress. However, the embarrassing stalemate was the worst of its kind since before the American Civil War.
Both of them just show how American politics is dominated by spectacle and political theater, while Americans who are suffering through terrible economic hardship right now and are politically polarized are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration. And it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress, because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty to have some sunlight. He says he's worried as his child has developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is. But doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to the world is one family. In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government to adopt a uniform refugee policy, which treats refugees equally, regardless of their faith or ethnicity. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are braving the cold weather and live in makeshift tents across the Indian subcontinent. These people, who always face the threat of detention and deportation, are here struggling for survival.
In this camp, children are getting sick and the sickness is unusual. They are getting chills, vomiting and fever. We have never seen this skin disease before. Even after visiting the doctor, the children are not getting any better. In every family, you will find children with this sickness. Now even women and men are getting affected. It's a very dangerous situation. Some say the sickness is spread to other camps. Doctors have advised us not to have guests from other camps and not to visit them.
Many refugees I spoke with shared heart-wrenching stories with me, and most of them kept asking why their voice is not being heard in the age of technology. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports suggest the real figure stands at hundreds of thousands. Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants in India and elsewhere after fleeing Myanmar. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect the Rohingyas' rights as refugees. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The inflation rate in Italy has been high for a while, breaking record after record. An increasing number of Italians are struggling to make ends meet, fearing that the cost of living pinch could soon turn into pain. The National Bureau of Statistics recently announced that the prices in the country rose more than 8% year on year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in 37 years.
It is impossible to continue this way. Gas and electricity bills have more than doubled, and the cost of bread and milk is going mad. This is pure madness.
Italy's annual inflation rate in December dropped to 11.6%, down from 11.8% in November, but the cost of living crisis keeps biting businesses and households hard. High energy prices caused by energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war is the main factor contributing to this surge.
The immediate loss of this situation has been the collapse of purchasing power by over 10%, which translates to the net loss of one monthly payment for employed workers. People on low income wages, such as employees and workmen, which represents 90% of the labor force, are among those suffering the most.
Analysts believe that a combination of high inflation, rising interest rates, and a lack of fiscal support will push Italy and other EU economies into recession.
Month after month, life is becoming increasingly tough. My retirement payment went up 50 euros 2 months ago, but the cost of living has increased by 200 euros each month.
Life is more expensive for those who live on one income only. The cost of renting houses, buying clothes for our kids, food. I can't see how we'll be able to face all this.
With the aim to fight high inflation and put prices under control, the European Central Bank has raised interest rates. The move is likely to hamper the European economy further. Some ministers in the Italian government have strongly criticized the ECB over its aggressive monetary policy that they believe could raise the prospect of recession. Max Civili, Rome.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Biden has maintained many of Trump's sanctions against Cuba. Cuba says Biden applies blockade even more aggressively than his predecessors. On November 3rd, for the 30th time, the United Nations General Assembly called for an end to the illegal U.S. blockade against Cuba. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, the current U.S. government, the one of Joseph Biden, of all those that the Cuban Revolution has known, is the one that has most aggressively and effectively applied the economic blockade. Carlos Fernandez do Concio, Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs of Cuba, declared in a speech on December 14th, adding, "It is the one that punishes the most, the one that causes the most damage to the daily life of Cubans and the economy as a whole." Fernandez do Concio cited the disruption of Cuba's fuel receipt by sea and the extraordinary flow of Cuban migrants as examples of the severe harms that Cubans have faced under the Biden administration's implementation of the blockade. In his address at a conversation series on Cuba in the Foreign Policy of the United States of America held on December 14th at the Higher Institute of the International Relations in Havana, Fernandez do Concio took aim at the Biden administration's enforcement of the blockade against Cuba, stating, "There can be no doubt that the economic blockade is the defining factor in the bilateral relations between the United States and Cuba." Biden pledged during his 2020 presidential campaign that he would try to reverse the failed Trump policies that inflicted harm on Cubans and their families. In 2021, he claimed, "We stand with the Cuban people." But Biden's actions belie his words. Fernandez do Concio said that Biden has applied with absolute and surprising loyalty the policy of maximum economic pressure that was designed by his predecessor, Donald Trump. Trump imposed 243 onerous new sanctions known as unilateral coercive measures in international law on Cuba as part of his maximum pressure strategy. More than 60 years ago, following the triumph of the 1959 Cuban Revolution, the U.S. regime imposed an economic embargo on Cuba. The rationale for the embargo was detailed in a State Department memo that advocated the disenchantment and disaffection of the Cuban people through economic dissatisfaction and hardship so they would overthrow the Fidel Castro government. The memo recommended the denial of money and supplies to Cuba to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow of government. The embargo is not a single law, but a complex patchwork of laws, presidential proclamations, and regulations that Fidel Castro once called a tangled ball of yarn. American University professor and Cuba scholar William M. Leo Grand wrote in the National Security Archive, "It has evolved over the 60 years since President John F. Kennedy put it in place, loosening and tightening from one administration to the next, depending on the president's preference for using hard power or soft power in dealing with Cuba. Since the Cuban Revolution, the United States has waged an unceasing assault, both military and economic, against the Cuban people, organizing an invasion, assassinations, terrorist attacks against civilians, and systematic economic sabotage," Isaac Saini wrote at Resumen. "The blockade has cost Cuba more than $130 billion in damage, according to the United Nations." Fernandez do Castillo also mentioned the Biden administration's commitment in May to allow remittances to Cuba, but said that it still has not happened and there is no commitment to dismantle the measures announced by the Trump administration to disrupt the remittances. In addition, although the U.S. regime announced measures to boost internet penetration and interconnection in Cuba, the U.S. regime still prohibits access for Cubans to more than 200 private commercial websites, according to Fernandez do Castillo. This includes sites for education, health, science and technology, art, culture and innovation. The U.S. regime, Fernandez do Castillo stated, admits that it intends to promote the Cuban private sector, not to contribute to the development of the Cuban economy, not to improve the standard of the living of the population, not to help a majority sector of the population, but rather identifies it as an instrument of political subversion, a political weapon. Dozens of lawyers have signed an open letter to Biden stating there is no legal or moral justification for Cuba to remain on the state sponsors of terrorism list. They wrote, Biden has the power to remove Cuba from the list and reverse many Trump-era sanctions through executive action. However, Biden has chosen to defend Trump's aggressive policies. Trump also stiffened the economic and travel blockade and activated Title III of Helms-Burton Act, which was enacted to discourage foreign investments in Cuba. Trump's activation of Title III green-lighted the thousands of lawsuits that will discourage tourism and investment in Cuba. In one such lawsuit, U.S. District Judge Beth Bloom issued an order on December 30 against four Florida-based cruise shipping companies that sailed to Cuba, requiring them to pay more than $400 million in damages. Fernandez do Castillo pointed out that Biden could have suspended Title III like Trump's predecessors. Activating Title III has had a deterrent impact on our development purpose of attracting foreign capital, he added. In addition, the Biden administration could have ceased the practice of pressuring governments in Africa, Asia, and Latin America to refuse medical cooperation provided by Cuba, Fernandez do Castillo said, adding, this U.S. action, of course, is intended to prevent dozens of thousands of people from receiving medical services, which is what Cuban doctors provide. Biden could also have ended punitive measures, threats, and persecution against fuel exporting companies, shipping companies, port agencies, insurance and reinsurance agencies, all aimed at depriving Cuba of fuel supplies that our country requires to function, which has had an extremely severe impact on the economy and the lives of the Cuban people, according to Fernandez do Castillo. The blockade, the vice minister said, has an impact on everything that includes electrical service, transportation, the availability of medicine and material for medical services, and the ability to obtain supplies for food production and building materials. The U.S. government cannot pretend to treat Cuba as if it were part of its territory, or treat Cuba as if it were a colonial dominion, or treat Cuba as if it were an adversary defeated in a war. We are none of the three, Fernandez do Castillo declared. He cited Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's observation that the intention of the U.S. regime is to strangle the Cuban economy and thus try to provoke social collapse and a political crisis in Cuba. Although the U.S. regime has failed in that purpose, it has led to economic depression in Cuba and the extraordinary flow of Cuban migrants. The embargo's overt purpose is to strangle the Cuban economy to promote regime change, according to the Alliance for Cuba Engagement and Respect, ACERE, a coalition of organizations working to end the Cuba blockade. The United States regime spends more than $25 million each year to fund regime change programs against Cuba. On November 3rd, for the 30th time, the United Nations General Assembly called for an end to the illegal U.S. blockade against Cuba. The vote was 185 in favor, 2 opposed, the U.S. and the fabricated regime of Israel, and 2 abstentions, Brazil and Ukraine. The resolution affirmed the sovereign equality of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal affairs, and freedom of international trade and navigation, which are also enshrined in many international legal instruments.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesley. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the new year 2023, there isn't much to cheer about, economically speaking. That is because the news is grim when it comes to the state of the world economy. And that is an understatement. The World Bank has made a big cut to its 2023 growth outlook, saying that the globe is perilously close to recession. This is while going into the new year, the world was suffering from massive inflation, like in the EU and the US, as examples. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the reasons behind this gloomy outlook, how we got to this in the first place, and whether there are any signs that the world economy will improve anytime soon. Joining us to discuss this is Clive Menzies, researcher and political economy analyst, who joins us from London. Clive Menzies, welcome. So, there's a barrage of bad news that's coming out, so it was worthy of us to try to explore that in this program. One of them is the World Bank making big cuts to its forecast, I guess, for 2023. The global growth outlook, it has stated, is perilously close to recession, where it slashes economy or growth outlook for the economy to 1.7% for 2023 from 3% projection that it had set. What do you think is going on here? I mean, what can we say about this?
Well, I think good evening. And I think one should not be surprised by what's happening. What I find quite incredible is that anybody who follows the sort of the blow-by-blow accounts in the mainstream media doesn't seem to be able to stand back and look at the trajectory that we have been following. And this was predictable probably since the global financial crisis in 2008, primarily because of the responses thereto. And we were warning as long ago as 7 years ago that we were heading for a global economic collapse. And last summer, when the governor of the Bank of England was suggesting that they were going to adhere to their 2% inflation target, that seemed somewhat laughable. The primary mechanisms that are causing this crisis have been long standing. One is the excessive money supply. So there's been money supply or money printing by the central banks, the major central banks, ever since 2008, and that has accelerated in the last 3 years, since September 2019, specifically with the Fed. This whole false climate narrative that has been fabricated with the ESG diktat that all companies have to conform to is also a contributory factor because it's driven up energy costs. And I know that the World Bank cited Ukraine as being one of the factors in all of this, but actually it is nothing to do with Ukraine itself. It's to do with the sanctions. I was on a program in May 2022 where all of the commentators, including myself, were suggesting that the EU and primarily shot itself in the foot, but with America's encouragement, because it's the sanctions that has created this this acute problem that we have now. But having said all that, even without Ukraine war, we would still be in this mess, because the trajectory has been driving us here through excess money and energy policies that make no sense and have no basis in reality, because there is no climate crisis.
All right, so I jotted down some of the things that you were talking about, and I want to ask you about this one particular one that is mentioned time and again, and you have also mentioned that time and again, and that is the fact that is somewhat, obscure or not really that clear when it comes to money supply, money printing, and the excess money. You know, we keep hearing about this, so the first question is, what is the theory behind it? But more importantly, where did the money go? I mean, you know, we're talking about a lot of money here that was pumped out by the central banks, correct?
Indeed. There was an article I wrote in an investment magazine, I think it was in 2018, where I showed a graph showing central bank, primarily the Fed and the ECB, and I think there may have been the Bank of England. And if you track the trajectory of the S&P 500, so it's an investment index of one of the main board indices of the American stock market, you could actually track that when the market weakened off, the central banks would intervene and create more money. And the mechanism that they used was primarily by basically taking bad debt off the commercial banks' books and basically just issuing more debt. And I don't know if you've seen more recently than in Japan, for example, they've actually gone to another stage of money creation, which is probably going to blow up in their face. So is central banks
around
the world.
What stage is that? What kind of program are you referring to with Japan that you mentioned there?
Well, it's something I've not looked into more recently. It was reported on UK column yesterday by David Scott that the Bank of Japan, not only have they increased their main base rate from 0.25 to 0.50, but they've undertaken a further buying program of government bonds. So they issue new government bonds and they take them on their own books. So it's just monetizing the debt. You ask where the money goes. The money, up until quite recently, until this inflation in the real economy started, has been going into asset prices, which is why we've seen stock markets, property prices, and all sorts of investments actually achieve record highs. What has happened, obviously, in the so-called COVID period, which is a whole other debate, basically they collapsed the real economy, so it wouldn't, all this money printing wouldn't actually appear in the real economy. Now that the COVID story has, if you like, rolled back because people are less amenable to being sort of intimidated into closing down their economic activity, there is now obviously activity, and we're seeing it creeping in on food prices, energy prices, etc. And let's not forget, along with this climate nonsense, they're also trying to destroy food production, particularly in Holland, where there has been a policy to actually stop people farming. And that is not exclusive to Holland. It's been a general trend across
Western...
Why
would they do that?
That's a very big question that has an answer. But essentially, we've been at war since 2001, and this is a war of the structure, which is those that believe that they can control the world centrally. They believe that there are too many of us on the planet, 7.8 billion or whatever the latest figure is. So they're looking to reduce the population and at the same time exercise control. And if you control food, then you control populations. I'm afraid that these sorts of ideas you will never see in a mainstream narrative, because They just seem too fantastical. But when you look at the work, the research that we've been involved in, this is a collaborative research project looking out from many different perspectives, shows that this is undoubtedly agenda. That's what COVID was about. That's what climate change is about. And this is what the, if you like, the destruction and the so-called greening of the planet is about, is to destroy farming and food production. And I'm not saying that agribusinesses or industrial-scale farming should be protected, because there are better ways of doing things. But this is all about centralizing control, centralizing production, and reducing everybody's footprint, which effectively means that the carbon they are trying to reduce is the carbon life form, which is human beings.
Well, when you talk about the food, I'm looking down at what I have on food for to propose a question to you for. And I'm looking at food insecurity, where it's projected to reach a new peak, which was last experienced in 2007, 2008. And it cites a combination of factors, and it says the supply chain disruptions, COVID-19 pandemic, the war in Ukraine, rising inflation and high commodity prices. But the narrative that you just spelled out is somewhat different. It may contain that, but it's somewhat different. Clive, you're going into the fact that you are saying overall that you want, that you're saying that this is going to be centrally controlled in terms of, for example, food. And therefore, there is a push for the population to decrease as a result of the way that food supply is controlled. If I understood you correctly, is that accurate?
In small part, I think the two go together. There is a general. You only have to look across the world, more in the West than anywhere else, that they're actually reducing production of food. And one of the points that we made back in May, when this sanctions regime started against Russia because of what's going on in Ukraine, the sanctions were bound to be self-destructive, because Europe is heavily dependent on imports for food. And Russia has plenty of energy and it has plenty of food. So there is a concerted effort. There are certain areas of the states where you can actually be prosecuted for growing your own food. There are stories of people being arrested for feeding the hungry. I mean, these are small indicators of something much bigger. But this is all coordinated, because if you look through every government, whether you're talking about Canada, New Zealand, Australia, countries across Europe, they're all adopting the same policies. Now, is it coincidence or is it planned? And our analysis would suggest that most of this is run by those that control the money system, i.e. those that control the central banks and the large commercial banks. Uh-huh. And there is a concerted plan which brings together a lot of strands of what we've been talking about in terms of economic collapse, in order to create disruption, in order to reorder the world. I think there's a Latin phrase which escapes me at the moment, but it essentially means order out of chaos, and that is the strategy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let me introduce our guest, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Brussels. Welcome. You've walked into, if I was walking into this conversation, I wouldn't know where to start. But Elijah Magnier, I'll start with one of the statements that amongst many bleak predictions for the world for the year 2023, This one I'm going to hit you with is from the IMF. One-third of the world economy expected to be in a recession. And it says it's because of the three big economies, U.S., EU, and China. And the bleak part of that, not that any of it was positive, says that half of EU is going to be in a recession. Elijah Magnier, what are we looking at when we're seeing all these bleak assessments that have been made? I'm sure you've read some of them, like this one from the IMF.
We are looking at the general recession that will hit the world, not only Europe or few part of the world, because the deterioration per capita income growth will be slower even in rich country, and that is due to several factors. Mainly, above all, is COVID, where the whole world was blocked for a very long time, and we were already told that we're going to be hit by an inflation. And secondly, are the U.S. measures against countries like Venezuela, Iran, and Russia to start imposing sanctions and prevent the flow of oil and energy that can contribute to bring down the prices, because everything follows the price of the oil. We have seen in March when the petrol reached $120 and today is around 80, when budget around the world in rich oil country producers is set up between $40 to $50 a barrel. So if we bring that down already and we lift all these sanctions, that is the best hobby of the U.S. to break the will of the population and impoverish the population, we have seen now that the U.S. has adopted another policy, pushing the EU to commit a suicide by imposing sanctions that have a devastating boomerang effect. And we in Europe are suffering greatly. We pay the bill of gas and electricity. I used to pay 70 euros per month. A few days ago, I paid 340, and I am one individual living in a small place. So we can imagine the effect of prices on everything else that is affected in the market, and we can't live.
So what do you mean when you say the U.S. is pursuing a boomerang effect type approach? Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, Russia sells the gas to Europe and to China and to other countries with 30% discount. Today, we're buying it at the price market plus 4 to 10% from Norway and from the U.S., but we're also buying it from Azerbaijan, from Algeria, but we're paying much more than the price that we used to pay. Moreover, Europe is not equipped to liquid gas that we are buying from the US and other places because we don't have these terminals. All the economy is based on that, and then we have to renew all the infrastructure. We don't have the money to do it, and that will cost a lot. And then we see many companies are closing their doors. And by closing the doors and seeing China that is buying the Russian gas at 30% discount of the Russian price, then the economy in Russia is going to be more attractive than the European industry because it's going to be much more expensive. The Chinese industry is going to be available at a very adequate price that we cannot afford because we're paying the price of energy much higher, and then we're paying also the price of food, the transport, everything else follows the price of the energy. So if the U.S. stop playing with this very dangerous game by imposing sanctions on countries, by now pushing Russia, pushing China to an arms race by signing deals with Taiwan, with Japan, by increasing the Japanese GDP of weapons and armament, the double, by the UK signing another deal with Japan today, all that give us an indication that the US are really insinuating to the Chinese, we're going to come after you through Taiwan, and that will create tension the market is not going to like at all. This is why there will be a panic again in the market, where there will be many areas of insecurity, and that will increase the inflation, hence the recession, is going to hit us all.
Clive Menzies, tell us the role that the U.S. and the U.S. economy actually plays in this whole thing, because we know on the one hand the U.S. financial system is integrated throughout the world in terms of how it can impact the flow of money, the dollar and its function, and of course the what our guest there from Brussels was saying, the U.S. foreign policy approach is in terms of sanctions, for example, sanctioning countries like Russia, like China, and even Iran, and how this all emanates from the U.S. in some sense that perhaps affects the world economic growth. I mean, if that even makes sense for me to ask it that way.
Yes, I think it does. I mean, we've lived in a dollar world since the end of World War II, or Bretton Woods. And I think what's becoming increasingly obvious is that certainly in the last year or so, but probably for quite a long time before that, the dollar, its days are numbered. In addition, the U.S. has basically been leaning on most other countries because of its military might and the strength of the dollar. And that is less potent than it used to be. I mean, by population, I think in terms of numbers of people, when you take in India, China, and other countries, the majority of the global population are against what America is doing in Ukraine, for example. And if one looks at what is happening, what is clearly evident from the Ukraine conflict is that Russian military sophistication could possibly exceed that of the US. There is certainly problems in the UK military in terms of morale and political correctness has sort of crept in and reduced its effectiveness as a force. So I think this, we're witnessing a dying empire, but what we're seeing more than anything is plunder. So the Biden administration is heavily involved in the corruption. The Ukraine, even before March this year, had turned into some sort of gangster state where there's a lot of money laundering going on. You may be aware of the FTX debacle where this cryptocurrency outfit has been washing money through Ukraine back into the Democrat Party.
Right.
And we're seeing the end of plunder and, okay. and it's so obvious everywhere, but it's being led from the States.
Sure. Sorry to jump in here and cut you off, but I just want to give Elijah Magnier, and unfortunately we're out of time, the last question here. So Elijah Magnier, when you take a look at countries that have the energy, i.e. oil and gas, such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, Venezuela, we're looking at countries that are not pro-U.S., obviously, because these are being sanctioned. How much of a factor will that play in if they were to unite against the U.S. in terms of trying to regain that whole idea of globalization and not have what the world is experiencing now, which is this high energy prices, and that for there to be a balance. But, of course, the U.S. would be left out. Under a minute, if you can.
Well, what the Americans are doing is allowing Venezuela to produce between 200,000 to 400,000 barrels of oil per day, enough for Venezuela to survive and for the Americans to take what they need because they import 700,000 from Russia. So they find alternative, but not enough for Venezuela to survive. If